Good morning. I call the Human Services, Finance and Policy Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. We will start with the approval minutes of March 19th. Representative Murphy moves.
Yes, so move.
All right, Representative Murphy moves the approval of the minutes for March 13, 2025. Any discussions? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none, the minutes are adopted. With that, members, we've got a heavy agenda item. So for those who are going to be presenting, please be conscious of time. So the first bill before us today is House File 2216, Chair Moller. As Chair Moller comes to the testify table, I move House File 2216 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an amendment, the A1 amendment.
There's an amendment, A1 amendment. Members, this puts the bill in the shape the author wants. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Seeing none, A1 amendment is adopted. Please proceed as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this bill is constituent-driven, and you'll hear from one of my constituents shortly. She came to me with a series of very concerning issues with her mother and her aunt's assisted living facility. The treatment her family received in assisted living shocked me. I reached out to experts in elder justice and learned that this was not an isolated or one-off incident. People with Alzheimer's or other conditions entered AL, assisted living, as private pay residents and quickly spent down tens of thousands of dollars for services they either didn't receive or had dramatic cost increases and didn't receive that level of services in return, only to be kicked to the curb when they ran out of money. They were going to go on a waiver, they were told there wouldn't be a bed for them, and they were going to get booted to the curb. So this bill seeks to help residents and prospective residents in three ways. It ensures access to elderly waiver, it prevents arbitrary price increases, and it helps ensure access for hospital transitions. Sections 1, 5, and 9 of the bill prohibit assisted living nursing homes and community residential service settings from requiring guardianship as a condition of admission. This practice doesn't happen by all providers, but does happen, takes away people's independence. It also prolongs hospital stays, costing the healthcare systems hundreds of thousands of dollars. Guardianship is for the court to decide, not a long-term care provider. Section 3 of the bill states that if a facility changes ownership, the new owner must honor the current contract until they expire, and if they want to provide increase rates, they have to provide justification for that. This protection helps curb the practice of private equity and other for-profit companies who purchase and take over facilities and raise prices without adequate justification or providing those services. Section 4 requires assisted living facilities to provide documentation for rate increases above the consumer price index, as consumers are paying high prices for services without clear reason, and there's no correlation between price increase and quality of care. Section 7 and 8 of the bill address a longstanding issue of being kicked out of their homes when they switch from private pay to public pay. As I mentioned before, they can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars only to be told there's no place for them when it's gone. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. You have 2 minutes.
Well, my name is Susan Baster. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the chance for me to speak in support of SF-2522. I'm here on behalf of my mother, Sharmilyn Anderson, and my aunt, Carol Anderson. I am here today because of the continued stress our family encountered while our mom and aunt were in elder care facilities. I took my concerns to my representative, Kelly Moeller, who has helped create a bill to try and solve some of these problems. My mom was paying over $110,000 a year for rent and cares where she was living, and her charges for cares were going to increase $18,000 per year because of a new pay structure. The cares she was receiving would not change. Ultimately, our mom spent almost $500,000 until her death last December. My sisters and I advocated for our mom daily, and our fear was that if she ever needed elderly waiver or public assistance, would she be allowed to stay at this facility? They did have elderly waiver rooms, a limited number. This was a constant worry for my family, as this happened to my aunt. My aunt exhausted her life savings of about $400,000. We were told elderly waiver rooms were not available and she had to move. I feel this bill would reduce stress a family goes through by knowing that they won't be blindsided by huge price increases, and if elderly waiver or public assistance is needed, their loved one will not have to move. My hope is that a family can visit their loved one without having to constantly worry about the unexpected cost and the disruption of potentially having to move them. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. To the next slide, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Varney, and I'm here testifying in support of HF 2216. Thanks for this opportunity to speak on behalf of my mother, Rita Varney. I believe her story is important because it is representative of many other individuals and their families struggling with caring for aging parents and siblings. Rita, my mom, was born in 1929 and raised on a farm near Pine City, and she is the oldest of seven brothers and sisters who all helped with the daily chores of running a small farm. She lived independently in Minnesota until my two siblings and I convinced her to move back to Minnesota where the family could provide additional help. At age 93, she reluctantly agreed to move into an assisted living apartment. And when we were in that searching process, the biggest question we had was, what happens if she outlives her finances? Her current residence, Broadwell Senior Living, was chosen because they said the age-in-place model was how they operated, which meant that you could stay in the same room when you moved in, and if you had increased levels of care, you could stay in the same building. And that further, they were going to apply for elderly waiver status after they'd been open for 1 year. We thought this was the most important feature in selecting this place. On the day that she moved in, she fell in the parking lot and fractured her pelvis, and also a couple of months later fractured her hip. And we ended up having to spend a significant amount of money on transitional care that took place after that, drawing down on her personal savings. We had the assisted living place evaluate her, and they said they could return her to her residence, but there would be an additional $1,800 a month cost. And when we actually got back, the number that we saw for her monthly rent was $7,000, and it was really confusing cost structure. So I met with the director to find out what the status of their elderly waiver was, and I was told that they hadn't even started that process yet. And about 2 months later, I was told that Broadwell had been acquired by another entity. And so I kept asking them the same question. What is your expectation? Are you going to follow through with the earlier presentation of having elderly waiver available? All I got in reply was, we don't know yet, and it hasn't been determined. As a result of this uncertainty, Rita and our family are now faced with the rapid drawdown of her remaining savings and expecting the prospect of additional downsizing of her personal belongings, moving costs from one place to a new place where right now she's in a well-run and comfortable, familiar place, and she'll be moving into something that we just have no idea what it'll be at this point. This is for a 95-year-old woman, and that is a lot to expect. I suspect that this is not a unique situation, and also one that will become more common as increasing numbers of seniors survive into their 90s. We specifically looked for a place for Rita that she could afford and would provide peace of mind if she does outlive her finances. This series of events has left us without an assurance on either account. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and the challenges you have faced with also the spend down. As you talked about, people have to draw down their income and assets just to qualify for the program. So, but I just wanted to ask if we have anyone else who wants to testify, please come to the testify table. You have 2 minutes to testify, and we'll proceed to the next person. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Hubert on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, and I'm here today to share our concerns with House File 2216. And first, I would like to thank Representative Mueller for reaching out to us to discuss her bill, and we do look forward to meeting with her very soon to have a more detailed conversation. With that, we would like to raise some concerns with the sections pertaining to guardianship and conservatorship. Both of those items are complex and generally related to providing services for those who have serious medical or behavioral needs. And so while we agree it is not something for all circumstances, it is something that is helpful in some, it is important and the most ethical and best option for the resident as well as the facility in some circumstances. So we will continue to talk with the author about that offline. This committee has heard in previous hearings that our county assessment process is pretty flawed here in the state. Recent data collected by the Imperative has found that many counties are completing their statutory 20-day assessment only 10% of the time. So elderly waiver applications are often taking 160 days or longer. That process is understandably frustrating for seniors and their families. It is also pretty frustrating for providers as reimbursement only starts once the application is completed and approved, not from the date of application itself. So the vast majority of providers very much want residents to remain in their home, but we cannot ignore the compounding impact of a lack of payer source. Finally, about 70% of assisted living facilities will need to raise staff wages and benefits to compete with the market impact of the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board mandates. So although we and our members raised these concerns with the board, they chose to move ahead anyway. And that is also why we are actually pretty appreciative of the author's concerns about residents and their ability to stay in their AL unit, as these types of mandates impact affordability for private pay residents as well. So again, look forward to further conversations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Burnt. I'm here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative to share our concerns in opposition to House File 2216. While the elderly waiver funding has significantly improved, we appreciate the increase 2 years ago, it still does not cover the full costs of services. The Imperative continues to advocate for an annual increase, as seen as in House File 1419, to ensure reimbursement grows to keep up with the growing costs to provide the services. Limiting housing and services cost increases to CPI creates serious headwinds for providers. When you recognize that there are no annual increases in the EW that I just mentioned, it does not set up a facility for long-term success. The exemption process also creates an administrative burden both on the facility and on the agency, who will have to oversee these requirements annually. These are ill-conceived and could have thousands of units each year to monitor and adjust for adjustments over CPI. These administrative costs will not improve the housing or services provided to residents. But let us call this what it is. It is a rent control policy. Economists have found that restrictive price ceilings reduce the supply of property to the market. The unintended consequences of such a policy can be seen outside this building across St. Paul. As we think about how we will house and care for our seniors in the future, this proposal as drafted could have significant chilling effect on new assisted living development. We recognize the issue of affordability that has been identified. However, we believe this is the wrong solution. We will continue our conversation with the author offline and proponents on the issues that they have identified. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And now we go to members' discussion. Representative Momani Hilsman.
Thank you so much, Chair Noor, and thank you for bringing this bill up. Representative As someone who has worked in a nursing home, assisted living facilities, I have firsthand witnessed the deep struggles that our seniors and their families face, and I have had I have seen the heartbreaks of families who, despite their best effort, cannot afford the care that their loved ones deserve. I have held hands of seniors who felt neglected when they didn't even have families who supported them or who are there close enough to even visit them. And I have just, you know, witnessed families who are forced to make impossible decisions between financial stability and ensuring their aging parents receive the dignity that they need. And I so appreciate that the center of this bill is focused on making sure that, you know, our seniors, our elderly, who've put in the work, get the care that they need. And I can't even imagine, because my family had the opportunity to care for my grandmother until she passed away in our own home. And so to sit here and try to navigate this very complex position of making sure that your loved ones has the financial support and the ability to live in a safe and in a place that is dignified is hard. And I want to thank you so much for bringing this up. And I hopefully we'll get to a solution where, you know, we can make sure that their families are getting what they need. Thank you.
Chamba.
Thank you, Chair. Just two questions. First question is we have two situations that's concerning. Number one, the testifiers, I always like to see when they're engaged. You know, they're great, they care and they're engaged, but we don't always have that in a nursing home or assisted living. So what happens if a resident cognitive they don't have a family member and they get an impairment that they can't make the choices for themselves or develops ones during it, and the family is not engaged or involved with care? How do we handle that, Chair?
Chair Muller.
Mr. Chair, well, I will say that it is certainly not up to these providers to be making that decision about guardianship, but I do have the ombudsperson here, and I would appreciate if she could answer that as well.
Please welcome and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Good morning, Committee. Pariche Rudina, Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. Representative Backer, thank you for your question. There are other decision-making systems that can be put in place. Supported decision-making is a way to get other individuals involved to support that individual you're describing, somebody who might have a cognitive impairment, to help that person make a decision that works for them. The analogy made there is we all have people in our lives who help us make decisions, and so this is a way to kind of formalize some of those relationships to have that support. Power of attorney documents, healthcare agents, those can be set up as well. Guardianship and conservatorship are the most restrictive ways of giving that decision-making authority to somebody else. So we just want to see guardianship and conservatorship not be the immediate fallback for residents who are in that situation. So I think there are other systems that can be used.
Chair Buck.
Yeah, follow up. And I appreciate that, but it doesn't always happen. Okay, as we all are aware of, because there's people, it creeps up to them quicker than we are. We as humans like to, unfortunately, procrastinate. Some of us don't have as strong as a support system. And we can see that in the suburban area and even in greater Minnesota. So I appreciate the answer. And I just want to acknowledge that not all residents have. I've seen it personally myself, responding to situations at home where we have a situation that we, and I know assisted living, but I've been in those situations like, who do we call? Who can we help? And you're really working hard on that. My second and last question is, you know, how long would it take for the commissioner to review plans and rate increases? I mean, what type of timeline would they have to do that, Chair Muller?
Chair Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are awaiting the fiscal note on that. Obviously, that will have a fiscal note, so I don't have that timeline or the amount yet for that. I will note that CPI, though, what we're doing here is in a number of other statutes. And so hopefully they can lean on some of these other areas. We asked for a list and got a list of, I don't even know, 25, 30 different areas where this type of, actually it's more than that. I just turned my sheet over and saw the list. So I have a very long list of other areas where this type of process is in place. And so hopefully they can lean on that.
No further questions. Thank you, Chair.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you. Chair Backer, too, for bringing that question. That's the question I was going to ask. On lines, 3.25, you know, like, I'm just going to go back to the commissioner conversation. I was under the impression that we at the legislature set the rates or proposed increases. Is it every facility can just make a change on just their increase? Are you talking about the rent or services that are provided? That's kind of what I was curious about.
Jim Mola.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll turn it over to the my testifier again, please.
Mr. Dina.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Representative Gilman, thank you for the question. In the instance where a family or a resident is paying privately, then the full decision-making about rent increases and service increases lies with that provider.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Okay, thank you so much. So then I'll just kind of go, I'll shift gears a little bit too. So again, as these facilities, which are businesses that are providing care, if this is adopted, then what would give them incentives to want to accept the elderly waiver at their facilities and not just have private pay folks? That's my question.
Chair Mola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think what the problem is, like one of the testifiers talked to, are some of these facilities say they have these waiver beds, so people are entering these with their private pay. And I will say, too, that these companies that are taking these private pay residents know the full financial picture of somebody before they enter, and they see how much money they have. And so some are advertising to them, your private pay, but if you run out of money, we have waiver beds here. But then when that person has probably outlived the expectation of the company, then they are told, we don't have a bed for you anymore.
Vice Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. And I'll just follow up. My mother-in-law has experienced assisted living and had, you know, experiences there, and I'm grateful for the people that have taken care of her. But as we see, like, margins shrink from the, you know, wage increases, you know, just the cost of living, different things like that, I think if we then only have the burden go on these companies to try to make these decisions so they can stay afloat. And so I just am wondering how we are going to have this be successful here.
Jim Wall.
Mr. Chair, yeah, thanks for that question. So this doesn't prevent them from raising over the cost of inflation. They just basically have to show their work as to why they're doing that. We're seeing private equities coming in to this industry right now and buying out these contracts and then not honoring the contracts and really raising rates extensively. And so if they want to raise rates to that effect beyond the CPI, they need to show their work.
All right. Thanks.
Representative Gund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My mother went through this exact sequence over the last 10 years. She lived very happily in an assisted living facility for about 5 or 6 years and was treated wonderfully, and then had an acute medical event and was hospitalized. She came through transitional care. As long as she showed improvement, Medicare would pay. She kind of stabilized, and the first time it happened, she was able to return to the assisted living facility for a couple more years until another acute event took place, back into the hospital, back through transitional care. Then she could no longer get well enough to return to assisted living and went to a full nursing home. I think it's important to say that as we watch these loved ones decline, we have angst, and sometimes we attach that angst to the nursing home or to the assisted living facility. Sometimes we do that, or maybe we attach it to our wives or our dog. I mean, we should really examine when we have angst, where is it coming from? Because I think we falsely attach it and probably become a little more critical of facilities than would be merited. And so misplaced angst, I think, is kind of a big deal as we grieve the decline of a loved one. Now, watching her acuity level go up and her monthly cost going up was irritating, but I think justified. And in the end, you know, they had to say, because she could not do certain things on her own any longer, she couldn't be in assisted living any longer. So I see how it happens. So like a fractured hip in this case, or other maybe a stroke where your need would suddenly change. Clearly, if you can stay at assisted living, the cost is going to go up. We don't like to hear of like a single $1,800 increase on cost, but acuity level demands it in a sudden health change. So let's not be too quick to say, whoa, that's a big increase at one time, because we know that with changing health conditions, that's a real thing. That's exactly how it goes. And then the last thing I would say, and then please respond to any part of this, and if you want to bring up any testifiers, it's a two-way street. I think things need to improve here for families in this condition, particularly if rates are being raised in the middle of a contract. To me, that's illegal, right? You're under contract. The rate should stay at least to the end of that contract. So certain things need to be looked at, hopefully maybe more surgically, but not to overreact. Because the last thing I would say, and then I would love to hear a response, is, again, door knocking all summer long. Many towns have lost their assisted living facilities because of new regulations that we've put upon them. So are we really serving aging people in our neighborhoods, in our cities, when we close their facilities and now they have to travel 60, 80, 100 miles to receive the care that they need in a facility that's not home, it's not near the people where they grew up? So really, overregulation isn't serving the end user very well either. So that's my view. Again, I know it comes from personal experience all along the way. But my challenge for us would be perhaps to be a bit more surgical in how we mark up the current legislation. This one, there's a lot of marked up stuff here that perhaps we could be a bit more surgical to a win-win for the end user, for the facility that does not want to be overregulated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Chair Mona.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for those comments. I will just note that the way the bill is drafted, it is for the same services and the increase in costs, not for those situations that you described. And of course, if there's a way to refine that and make that even clearer, I am always happy to do that. And I don't know if the testifier has any more to add to that.
Briefly, Ms. Sordina.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Representative Gander, I think a lot of what you say about grief and how we are responding to watching somebody we care about change is important. You know, I will say, just to underline Representative Mueller's comments, one of the changes our office is seeing in terms of complaints that come to us is residents are calling saying, my fees are going up, their rent's going up 2-3 times this year, but none of my services are changing. My condition hasn't changed. I'm getting the same care that I was getting yesterday. And so this is really, and again, you know, if there's a change of condition, yes, we would expect services and costs to go up. That's appropriate. But if the change of condition isn't there, then, you know, we want to make sure that those increase in costs have justification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just say again, if they're under contract, the contract needs to be honored.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, and then we'll go to Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Mueller. So budget and pricing are based on local cost. In my area, I've talked to my assisted living, groups a lot, and they said, you know, it's a very limited margin that we're dealing with. And so, assisted living, need to raise their wages to be able to compete or to get people. Do they need to have MDH approval to do that?
Chair Mueller, Ms. Rodina, I think there's someone from the agency here to respond. Well, they're not here.
She can.
We'll provide that information, particularly in terms of if they need approval to raise, but I don't think they need approval. Maybe we'll go to nonpartisan staff. This is more particularly in 144G, which is different than the other programs. Ms. Pinguet.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not aware that assisted living facilities need to have approval to increase wages at this point.
Representative Mathis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's a question that should be answered just because they're going to have to respond to staying afloat with margin. And so if they need a permission to raise wages so that they might have to raise their costs, this could definitely be a limitation for that. So definitely concerning to me. Just in general, some of the mandates that we put on all our facilities, assisted livings included for minimum wage, have cost our local businesses a lot annually. So so those are very concerning for me as far as what happens with the wages and their need. If they need to raise wages, can they raise the prices for their product? Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Mohler, thank you for chatting with me about this last week. I appreciate the heads up on this, and I do share the concerns that have been described today with this, but I do think that your intent is good and that you're actually interested in working on this and not just pushing this through. And so I do appreciate that. It calls to a larger issue that we have in this. And so thank you for deciding to take a human services bill, too, because it does call to the higher issue. When we look at the cost of what it takes to run an assisted living, and we look at what Elderly Waiver has been paying over the history of it, it hasn't really stayed caught up with the cost of the care that's being provided, and so that has to be made up somewhere. And so then that gets made up on the people who are there privately, which means that they lose their assets a whole lot faster. Now, the Democrats 2 years ago were able to give some real increases to the Elderly Waiver piece, and they should be commended for that, because today I believe that more and more facilities are looking at keeping their doors open versus closing or selling because of the work that had been done there by you all, not by me, with that. But with that shift, then we have these issues that come up, because Elderly Waiver, while there has been the increase, doesn't keep up, doesn't keep pace. And we see that in this area, we see that in most areas of healthcare, that we, when the private side is subsidizing for the public pay piece, that makes it difficult. I also do share concerns about the bad actors. I know a lot of times we get to go on tours, we get to talk to providers that are the good actors, the mom and pop. I met one yesterday from St. Paul, very charming woman. She has one house that she operates that's long-term assisted living, and the effects that this bill will have on her is difficult because she's one of the good actors, and you're trying to root out the bad actors with this. And I understand the bad actors because I've had facilities close in my district from that same thing. Private equity comes in, they milk the system for what it's worth, they close down, and that community is still reeling from those decisions from half a decade ago. And so there is a deep-seated anger in my heart for those kind of activities. At the same time, I don't want to cut off my nose despite my face on the other portions and the good people I met yesterday on these things too. And so I think there are areas that we can address without doing the harm piece as much on there. And so I do appreciate, like, the Section 3 piece of that, you know, we do, contracts need to be honored, and we've had that point. I have concerns on the CPI piece, and that the commissioner has to approve the increases above the CPI there, just because there are unique costs that just don't get pulled into that. And so that's an area that we certainly can look at. And again, to the bigger issue, this does call on, I think our first hearing, we talked about the county's ability to respond in a reasonable amount of time and how the county is failing on that. And I think it was Representative Hicks that gave quite the 101 lesson on why that's a problem. And that's really, for me, that's a bigger at root in this overall issue as we look at this and what we do there. is really how do we get the counties to respond in a reasonable time frame? Because at the end of the day, the facilitators are on the hook for that delay and what gets on there. And so I'm just wondering, in here, do you see anything that simplifies that process for the counties or streamlines it so that it's more of a universal piece for that, so that it's easier for providers to understand, so that it's easier for the people that they're providing services for to understand?
Mr. Rudina.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Thank you, Chair Schumacher, for the question. I think this is part of the presumptive eligibility conversation that is ongoing in terms of streamlining the Min Choices process. I will also add, this is some of the work that our office does. We do work with facilities and residents to ensure that applications are put in a timely manner, that the assessment is happening in a timely manner. And that is one way that we can help ensure that there is that seamless transition for somebody who's paying privately in October and then needs elderly waiver in November, because we do recognize that can be a challenge for providers. So as much forward planning as can be done, and I think working with residents and providers together can really help make that a smoother process.
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I'm happy to see that there's movement there and there's a recognition, and I think that that's one issue that we should continue to try and tackle this year. There are other questions and concerns with this, but the county piece really is a big one I had, and just the overall concern that this is just cutting off our nose despite our face with some of these people and affecting the good actors at the same time too. And so I know you have an agenda to run, so I'll leave it at that. But thank you for your continued work on this, Representative Mueller.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I know we've got a long agenda, so we'll try to keep the pace. Chair Mueller, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the robust conversation, and at least I heard some things about contracts need to be honored. So I'm gonna go with that. I will say, Chair Schumacher, to address your issue about the elderly waiver rates not catching up, the problem is these companies are advertising that they will take these private pay residents and then they'll have a bed for them. So they're aware of that, the rate issue, when they're making that promise to potential residents. To address, again, some of the guardianship concerns, I don't see in your packets a letter. It was posted online. It might have come in late from the Adult Representation Services that talks about their experience with some of these companies requiring guardianships and how very difficult it has been, especially because people can get stuck in the hospital with tens of thousands of dollars while they're waiting. So please encourage you to read that letter. This is not rent control, and I actually find it offensive that it's been called that by one of the testifiers. And I just want to say we'll continue to work on this. I welcome suggestions of how to make this bill bipartisan, and thanks to the testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair Mueller. I will renew my motion, House File 2216, as amended, to be laid over. So the bill is laid over. The next bill we have on the agenda is House File 1978. Representative Norris. While Representative Norris is coming to the testifier table, Representative Norris moves that House File 1978 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Knorr and members. It's great to be with you and present House File 1978. The genesis of this bill is really kind of how our democratic process is supposed to work. I was out door knocking back last summer and came to the door of one of my constituents, Mr. Sean O'Keefe. And we were having a nice chat, and I eventually asked him, is there anything that I can do for you up at the Capitol? And he said, well, actually, there is. Let me tell you about my daughter, Kenzie. And he proceeded to describe how Kenzie has a severe developmental disability and also type 1 diabetes. And he walked me through how the way the Min Choices assessment works, when you check the box for type 1 diabetes, it allocates about 25 minutes per day of care for that, since that's what someone with a normal adult intellect would require in order to manage their type 1 diabetes. However, when you pair that type 1 diabetes diagnosis with a severe developmental disability, Kenzie is someone who needs round-the-clock care because she can't manage her blood sugar by herself. And so the current systems that we have were really failing the O'Keefe family. And so I said, well, let's work on trying to find a solution to that. So we worked for many months with both Anoka County and the Department of Human Services and eventually came up with this bill. And this is a narrowly tailored bill. It addresses a specific interaction, developmental disability and type 1 diabetes. But I think what we've come to learn as I've brought this bill forward is that it's really this issue that the O'Keefes are facing is really symptomatic of a broader systemic issue, and that's that the MnChoices assessment is not appropriately accounting for interactions between multiple complex diagnoses. And so I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation beyond just this bill to figure out how can we try to make that assessment work better, not only for the families that are testifying with me today with this particular interaction, but all of these different interactions that we see in terms of complex diagnoses. I'd also just briefly like to thank Representative Gander for co-authoring this bill with me and understanding the challenges that these families face. And with that, Chair Noor, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Sean O'Keefe. And thank you, Representative Norris. I just want to call out he's done an amazing job for us, and the door knocking was very timely. Perfect. So he did mention some of the things I was going to say. We did meet with Anoka County. We did meet with DHS. This has been a two-year battle for us, and both of them have led us here. They've tried very hard within this current assessment to say, where can we find time for you. We realize you guys are not being serviced at all for the kind of care Kenzie needs. And they both ended up saying, you guys have to go to the state and write a new bill, which was very daunting for us, you know, until Matt knocked on our door. He stole some of my thunder on
That's
my car
right.
here. So my daughter is here. She's over there. She's here for two reasons. One, she really supports this bill, but she also has to be here because my wife is here, and Kenzie has to be tied to our hip, one of us, 24 hours a day because of her type 1 diabetes. She's 100% insulin dependent. She needs insulin injections all day long or carbs. It's a combination. And she can't manage that on her own. She's got a 4 to 5 year old intelligence, and she just can't do that. So Kenzie's 100% insulin dependent and 100% human dependent. The current assessment just doesn't have that in it at all. And let's see here. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to point out was when Kenzie was in school, because now she's out of school, and this is where it really, really came to fruition. Kenzie's in school, she gets a one-to-one para, because the school recognized their first job really was to keep Kenzie alive at school. And she also had nursing services everywhere she went. When school ended, certainly we knew we were going to go on a waiver. We didn't know anything about it at the time, but we knew it was going to happen, and we expected that some care would translate into the waiver. But there's a huge omission there, like Representative Norris said, and it just doesn't have it. And so the good news really today is that we're finally here after 2 years. This bill does solve the problem. It basically, you know, it almost replaces that school care. It asks for 9 hours of nursing care. And the reason we're asking for nursing care is because Minnesota law currently says that anyone that provides insulin to Kenzie either has to be a parent or it has to be a nurse. And so it's not really coming from us. It's coming from current law that mandates us to do that. And so we are here basically on behalf of Anoka County, on DHS, and on us to present this bill to you to please pass this bill to help us with Kenzie's care. It's caused me to quit my job, and anybody in Janelle is going to be faced that same situation in a few years when her daughter graduates from school. One of you are going to have to do the same. So with that,
Thank you, Mr. O'Keefe, and also thanks to Kenzie for joining us. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Janelle Trebojevic, and I'm here to testify on behalf of my family, my daughter Lexi, who's 15, and the O'Keefe family. My daughter also has intellectual disabilities. She has physical disabilities, visual impairment. She's also type 1 diabetic. Like Kenzie, Lexi is on a DD waiver. Developmentally, she's about 10. She can read, write, and do math about a kindergarten to second grade level. So like Kenzie, she does not have the ability to manage her diabetes entirely on her own. As she continues to get older and transition into adulthood, we're struggling to find and be able to afford care for her. At a younger age, as Sean mentioned, the school covers everything during the school day. She has a one-to-one para, but now that she's in high school, there's no before school, after school, summer programming with nursing support at a traditional child care rate. So now that she's 15, we don't know what to do. One of us has to be home at all times with her. My husband is not here today. He had to get Lexi on her bus. One of us has to be home every day to get her off the bus at 2 o'clock. So it creates a lot of challenges. In the summer, we don't have childcare, and we both have to go back to the office this year, and we have no idea what to do. We have to either work with our companies, or we're gonna have to split our vacation days to cover staying home with Lexi. Not exactly how you wanna spend your vacation. Split up, piecemealed, to make sure that we are covering her care. My mom is the only person we have today that can help us care for my daughter. She is a retired nurse. But as Lexi gets older, finishes high school, and my mom continues to enjoy her retirement, we don't have anybody to care for Lexi. 100% of our lives are based on her availability to help, and she's here today. So anytime we want to go on a date night, go to a concert, go to a son's activity, if I need to travel for work, is 100% based on her ability to help care for Lexi. So very restrictive because of this. So similar to the O'Keefe family, we have many tough decisions to make going forward. Like Sean said, is one of us going to have to quit our jobs once she graduates from high school? Or am I going to work just to pay for a nurse to care for Lexi? Because that funding is not covered today under the DD waiver. Should we be planning retirement for 3 people instead of 2 to make sure that we have appropriate care for Lexi and still have a life? So please consider passing this bill to provide nursing support funded by the CDCS waiver so our families can have the support we need to be able to care for Lexi and Kenzie in the way that they need without the financial and stressful burden to our families.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members' discussion. Representative Ganda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. I do support this bill as a stopgap measure to take care of families just like yours right now, and I also support a broader solution to cover folks like you and families like yours more long-term without having to do these small fixes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norris, so do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Noor, and again, thank you to the committee for your attention to this. I think you've heard 2 really compelling stories about how our current system is not working for Minnesota families, and so I'm looking forward to continuing to work with you all to not just find a solution for these families, but also find a way to make sure our system is working for all Minnesota families that need it.
Thank you for bringing the bill forward, and thanks to the testifiers for coming today. Looking forward to working with you to find a better solution. With that, House File 1978 is laid over. The next bill, Representative Norris again. House File 2354, please move your motion and proceed with the introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I move that House File 2354 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Minnesotans are a generous people. When our neighbors and our communities are struggling, we believe in offering them a helping hand. That's why it's disappointing, frustrating, and completely unacceptable when that generosity is taken advantage of. Medical assistance fraud steals from hardworking taxpayers across Minnesota. It also steals money that is meant to provide health care to low-income Minnesotans. That's disgraceful, and we're here today to crack down on this kind of fraud. Attorney General Ellison's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit already does great work catching people who steal from medical assistance and making sure that they're held accountable. Compared to similarly sized states, they've won the most convictions for provider fraud, and with an annual budget of about $5 to $6 million a year, in the last 5 years alone, they have recovered over $53 million in civil penalties and criminal restitution. But as our medical assistance budget grows, so too must the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. It's a mouthful. MFUCU, I think, is the acronym that they use. After all, it takes people to fight fraud. So this bill does a couple of things. It improves Attorney General Ellison's office's ability to investigate Medicaid fraud by expanding the office's subpoena powers to bring it on par with the same powers that county attorneys have when investigating these sorts of cases. It also brings the penalties for medical assistance fraud in line with other theft penalties, including a maximum penalty of up to 20 years in prison and a fine of up to $100,000 if you steal $35,000 or more. And lastly, we've seen a lot of attention on fraud related to grant programs in the Minnesota House. And while scrutinizing grants is important, for the Department of Human Services, only about 3% of the funds that go out the door are in the form of grants. Medicaid accounts for 89% of the funds that go out the door. So this bill is designed to scrutinize and make sure that we have program integrity on the largest source of funds that Department of Human Services provides to Minnesotans. And with that, Chair Noor, I have a couple of testifiers to provide more detail.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, members of the committee. I'm Nick Wonka, the director of the Minnesota's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is housed in the Attorney General's office, and I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2354, otherwise known as the MAP Act, which will help ensure that we in Minnesota continue to be able to investigate and prosecute fraudsters who steal taxpayer dollars that should be dedicated to providing critical health care services to Minnesota's most vulnerable populations. Minnesota's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit has existed for over 40 years. We're one of 53 in the country. Every state has one, as do D.C., Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Each one of us is funded by a federal grant from the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. That grant covers 75% of our funding and comes with conditions on what we can and cannot do. It requires us to spend 100% of our time investigating and prosecuting Medicaid provider fraud and the abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of vulnerable adults residing in certain settings. And as you can see from the handout, our investigators and prosecutors are good at what they do. Over the past 5 years, Minnesota has only spent about $5 million in state funds on our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. In that same time, our units won $53 million in restitution and recoveries from fraudsters. But with those federal requirements come certain prohibitions, too. We're the investigators and prosecutors, but we aren't the administrators of the program. For example, our federal regulations require us to be entirely separate from the agency that administers the Medicaid program, which here is DHS. So we can prosecute it, but we can't turn off payments on the front end or bar a certain provider from enrolling with Medicaid or continuing to receive payments. We also can't investigate or prosecute fraud in obtaining benefits, also known as welfare fraud, or fraud in other public programs. But those limitations have allowed us to specialize and be skilled at what we do. Our numbers back that up. We get audited from time to time by the Federal Office of Inspector General, and last time they looked at us in 2022, they noted we had more fraud convictions than other similarly sized Medicaid fraud units. We've continued that trend in the past few years as we've outpaced even larger, more well-funded units in provider fraud charges and convictions. So what we're asking you for today is the tools and resources to continue keeping up that good work. Minnesota's Medicaid budget has grown quite a bit in the past few years, but our med fraud unit has not. We're 32 people right now, and it's a dedicated group of skilled investigators, prosecutors, analysts, and legal support staff. What we're asking for is simply to match the recommendation for our unit staffing given to us by the federal department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. They calculate our staffing needs based on the size of our state Medicaid budget, more Medicaid dollars being paid for services, more staff needed to investigate fraud. That's why New York, California, Florida, Texas have hundreds of people, while South Dakota only has a handful. Our recommended number right now is 41, and that's what we're asking for. Be 9 additional people, 1 prosecutor, 7 investigators, 1 support staff. But the state would only be paying for 2 1/4, because the federal government will pay for the rest under our grant. And with those people and the additional tools we'll get through the MAP Act, we'll be better able to continue our mission to hold fraudsters and abusers accountable for their crimes. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else who wants to testify? Mr. Moussa Khalif, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, guys. My Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Musab Khalif with the Community Provider Alliance. To start, we would like to express our support for this bill's overall objective, especially the provisions in House File 2354 that increase funding and expand the authority of the Attorney General's office to address fraud. However, we have some critical concerns regarding this bill, specifically Section 3, lines 2.14 and 3.33, which we feel need to be modified with more precise and unambiguous language. To save us time, we won't go into the details of what we mean by that, but without having clear and precise language, as the Supreme Court of our state has said, then it's kind of going to be a free-for-all. Laws are going to be subjectively applied as opposed to objectively applied. In conclusion, we support the bill, but we have concerns about it, specifically the language and the potential impact on individuals' right to due process. We hope that the bill's proponents will work with us to address these issues. Given our preliminary discussions with these proponents of the bill, we're confident that we're going to come to an agreement in addressing these issues. Lastly, I would like to end with this. As we are discussing the broader theme of fraud and abuse, I would like to press upon you guys that there is a trade-off of having too much regulation and the impact of that on providers. Having providers being efficient will also save us money. We have a looming crisis with a lot of people coming into Medicaid and Medicare over the next 10 years. Senator Hoffman endearingly calls them the silver tsunami, is what he calls it. That's going to be very expensive for our state to handle, and it requires us to address and go after these thieves harshly. But simultaneously, we must make sure that providers are not feeling scared so they don't innovate, they don't iterate, and do better with their operations. The two have to go hand in hand. And having good laws that are clear, unambiguous, precise will help us get there. Don't take it from me. Take it from the Minnesota Supreme Court, who said the current tools that the normal tools that they use to address and interpret the laws are not useful because the laws haven't been updated for decades. We need the laws to be clear. Sorry for going off on a tangent, but I think it's important for you guys to have a comprehensive understanding of what's happening, right? Both sides. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for testimony. Do we have anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members discussion. Don't see anybody. So with that, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Want to thank the Attorney General's office for bringing this bill forward. Obviously, I think this is a good step that we should be taking to make sure that we have program integrity in our Medicaid units. I also think it's great to highlight that this is going to be a 3-to-1 match from the federal government. So when you look at what this unit has been able to recover in terms of fines and restitution, you combine that with the fact that the federal government will be matching this small state appropriation 3-to-1. I think this is a real winner, and I would ask for the committee's support.
With that, I renew my motion. Representative Norris renews his motion that House File 2354 be referred to Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The motion prevails. You're on your way to public safety. So thank you so much. The next bill before us is House File 1963. Representative Frederick. As you come to the testifier table, I will move that House File 1963 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. House File 1963 is the March policy bill. Section 1 kind of stems from a conversation that I had with March in that they had some providers that would receive a bill from an insurance company like 3 years after the fact looking to recoup funds, but if they made an error or if there was some mistake on their end as well, that they couldn't in turn ask for that payment. And so Section 1 just says that if an insurance company is going to come after a pact to recoup funds, then they can also address those same concerns. Section 2 is talking about data requirements. If there's a closure of an RCO, that the people receiving services can get documentation of the services that they received. Section 3 talks about the mental health diagnostic assessment, and then Section 4 is the diagnostic services. So just for the sake of time, I'll turn it over to testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Zervis. I'm the Executive Director of MARCH, Statewide Trade Association for Substance Use Disorder Programs and Professionals. I'll keep my comments brief. I want to thank Representative Frederick. He did a good job on the overview. A couple additional points on Section 3, the DA timelines. That timeline would specifically exclude weekends and holidays. The issue we see from small programs and rural programs is they don't have mental health professionals staffed on weekends. So for some of these programs that get a rate enhancement, there is a timeline that they have to do a diagnostic assessment within 10 days of service initiation. So we are hoping to have that exclusion of weekends and holidays give those programs a little bit of breathing room. And then lastly, on the Section 4 is withdrawal management, county financial responsibility. Would clarify that for withdrawal management programs, the county of residence is a county of financial responsibility. So that'll conclude, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would also like to, I have an amendment to the bill, the A1 amendment. It just changes one line on the second, on page 2, and it says change from may to must.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Mike Beltowski. I serve as the Vice President of Program Development at Horowitz Health and the Treasurer of MARCH. I'm here to emphasize the critical need for the policy updates to strengthen withdrawal management services in Minnesota, ensuring financial sustainability for providers and continued access for life-saving care. Our field is at a pivotal moment. House File 1963 introduces key policy updates that provide real hope for providers, allowing us to continue serving Minnesotans at a time when every small policy change matters. One of the updates I represent is the clarification of county financial responsibility, CFR, for withdrawal management. Currently, detoxification CFR is based on the county where an individual is physically located when the need for services arises. However, withdrawal management is both a commercial and Medicaid-covered benefit that has traditionally followed the services definition, including alignment with behavioral health fund applications. Despite detox and withdrawal management often being used interchangeably, they are distinct services, each requiring clear financial responsibility to ensure sustainable service delivery in alignment with public policy intent of 245F.01, which emphasizes equitable access to medically appropriate withdrawal management services regardless of an individual's ability to pay. To address this, and in collaboration with the MAXA Behavioral Health Group, we propose the statutory update to clarify CFR for withdrawal management as presented. In addition, House File 1963 includes other vital updates that impact provider viability. Section 1 ensures that managed care organizations, if they issue a clawback, the timely filing clock resets, allowing providers to submit corrected claims. Section 2 establishes program closure requirements for recovery community organizations to match those of DHS licensed programs. Section 3 updates diagnostic assessment timelines and co-occurring enhanced programs to exclude weekends and holidays. This update supports our small and rural providers. Section 4, as mentioned, clarifies the CFR for withdrawal management, mirroring state policies and ensuring Minnesota's withdrawal management programs remain accessible, sustainable, and responsive to our community needs. These relatively small updates protect sustainability, improve service continuity, and reinforce our state's commitment to behavioral health care. By passing House File 1963, we ensure that withdrawal management services remain accessible, stable, and responsive to Minnesota's needs. I urge your support for these updates, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I think we have good also testify via Zoom. We'll skip that one. Do we have anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? See none. Member discussion. Do we have any discussion on the bill? Seeing none, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Appreciate support for the bill, and I would renew my motion to lay over House File 1963 as amended to be included in a future committee bill.
The bill is laid over. To the next bill, House File 1994.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. House File 1994 is a bill to talk about rates. We hear about rates from a lot of different spaces and the need to increase rates and so people can provide the good work across the state of Minnesota. This is the bill to do that in the substance use disorder space. And with that, I would like to turn it over to testifiers.
Welcome again. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Brian Zervis with March. So a brief overview of this bill. This is something March has been working on year over year. Section 1 clarifies existing language for substance disorder. Section 2 is the substance disorder rates as identified in the outpatient rate study that was presented to this body in January of 2024. Section 3 has an automatic inflation adjustment, again with the idea that ideally, these programs shouldn't have to come and fight year after year to get rates that match the cost of delivering care. Section 4 has cleanup for substance disorder cross-references, and then Article 2 is a set of recodifying instructions as identified by Senate Counsel. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Norman and Nora and committee members. My name is Dr. Roy John Sutherland. I am the Vice President of Addiction Services for Nystrom & Associates. I'm a licensed psychologist, a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, and I'm an elected member of the March Board of Governors. Nystrom & Associates has over 60 locations specializing in psychiatry, therapy, and addiction services. Of our 60 locations, we have 31 outpatient and one residential SUD program. Last year, within SUD, we served 8,400 unique patients and over 108,000 counters. We provide services for both adults and adolescents. For over a decade, there has been numerous rate studies. In the most recent study by Burns and Associates, cost-based rates were specifically looked at. The conclusion of the study identified 8 of 9 rates that were underfunded, resulting in recommendations of an average increase of 68% to remain financially viable. As a result of this, the grossly underfunded industry, 47 programs in the past 3 years have closed statewide. I want to say that again. 47 programs in the past 3 years have closed statewide. For over 14 years, the industry has seen nominal increases in outpatient reimbursement rates, resulting in providers being stretched to do more with less. We are all for efficiencies and reducing costs. I do that every day. However, providing outstanding services does come at a cost. Our industry is at a breaking point where increased salaries, benefits, a reduced workforce, and regulatory requirements put significant strain on our providers and organizations alike. It's difficult to provide life-saving programs when the cost is outpacing the revenue coming in. Our staff-to-patient ratios have increased. Providers are tired, and they're leaving the field for careers that do not include emotional strain, allow for life-work balance, while also paying them more to support their families. This is of grave concern to me, as I am someone who has dedicated my career to helping people live better lives and strengthen their futures. According to the literature, the investment in mental health and addiction is well worth the upfront cost. The following are some of those benefits. Lower healthcare costs. Early intervention prevents severe conditions that require expensive emergency care or hospitalization. We spend a lot more of our funds when patients show up in the emergency rooms and they're boarded in the hallways versus going into these treatment programs. Lower suicide rates. Access to mental health care reduces the risk of suicide, which has both an emotional and economic consequence. It reduces the spread of infectious diseases, as substance abuse are often linked to the spread of diseases like HIV and hepatitis. Stronger families and communities. Mental health and addiction treatment help individuals maintain stable relationships, reduces domestic violence, child neglect, and reduces criminal activities. Ultimately, the studies have shown that for every $1 invested in mental health and addiction treatment, society actually gains $4 to $7 in economic returns through reduced healthcare costs, increased productivity, and lower crime rates. In conclusion, investing in addiction services is not just a compassionate choice. It's a financially sound and strategic investment that leads to healthier individuals, stronger economies, and safer communities. The long-term societal benefits far outweigh the initial cost of increasing reimbursement rates. Please do pass through HF 1994 seeking to implement SUD rates from the outpatient study at 100% of model rates with annual automatic inflation adjustments. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you. To the next testifier, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members. My name is Dr. Lou Zeidner, and I serve as the CEO of EOSIS, formerly known as Meridian Behavioral Health. EOSIS has been providing substance use disorder and co-occurring mental health care to patients throughout the state for over 25 years. We have 13 residential and 7 outpatient programs from East Grand Forks to Owatonna, from Stillwater to Waverly. We represent about 25% of the Medicaid beds for these services in the state. Without the proposed rate increase, we will go out of business before the end of the year. The 7,500 Medicaid and Behavioral Health Fund patients that we treat each year will lose access to the care we provide, and our staff will lose their jobs, often moving to roles in adjacent states and programs treating exclusively commercial insurance patients. In the 15 years since 2011, when the state began setting Medicaid rates for SUD services, residential SUD reimbursement rates have only been increased by $39, or 15.7%, while labor rates during the same period have increased by 55%. To put it simply, costs have increased dramatically faster than rates, and it's not sustainable. No business can sustain annual wage increases without service rate increases. We are not any different. Our providers in the field have already started dropping out of the marketplace, and it's going to get worse without rate increases. It's not an issue of overpaying anyone. There is not a single employee in our organization who could not get more by going elsewhere. providers in neighboring states receive up to double the reimbursement and have poached employees across state lines from Moorhead and East Grand Forks. Providers that service commercial insurance patients have also pushed up local payroll costs. For the exact same service, North Dakota's Medicaid rates are more than double ours. South Dakota's are roughly 20% higher than ours. Our business financial challenges are a function of low reimbursement rate years and years of wage increases and general inflation. We recognize that the legislature has many priorities to address and that available monies are tight. Effective treatment for substance use and mental health disorders reduces downstream costs in medical care, corrections, and general community challenges. The decision to raise rates lies with you, the members of the legislature. If rates are not increased, the consequence to your constituents and people throughout Minnesota are the result of reduced access to SUD care will be devastating. We urge the committee to support this bill, including rate increases for residential substance use and related care. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And for the final testifier on the bill, we have someone via Zoom.
Hello, I believe that's me. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Sadie Brockmeyer, and I'm testifying today as a member of the board of the Minnesota Alliance of Rural Treatment Providers, also known as MERITAP. And MERITAP is a 501c6 nonprofit organization that seeks to bring together diverse rural interests and to address and advocate for strong and evidence-based addiction programs throughout greater Minnesota. Formed in 2017, MERITAP advocates for the legislation and policies that strengthen the health and well-being of rural Minnesotans and improve rural access to higher quality, lower cost, and health care. A lot of what I'm going to say is going to be reiterated by the two testifiers previously. I'm going to try and emphasize more on the rural aspect of the concern. And I'm here today to provide MERITAP support to support the House File 1994 and the importance of the significant investment in the state substance use disorder treatment infrastructure. As you've already heard, the Department of Human Services 2024 rate study confirmed that we in this field have known for years. But it is to highlight how large the gap between medical assistant reimbursement and the cost of providing quality substance use disorder treatment is. The gap is particularly noticeable for organizations like Recovering Hope Treatment Center, where I work in Mora, Minnesota, that serve in rural communities where the overwhelming majority of our clients are covered by medical assistance or the Behavioral Health Fund. Specifically in Kanabec County, where Recovering Hope Treatment Center is located, we are not only struggling with the limited funding to recruit providers, but for the overall cost of providing quality and evidence-based care has increased due to things like providing health insurance for our employees, liability insurance to cover our providers, medication management, all of the services that we provide. Property taxes have gone up and increased in our county and our city. Food cost, gas cost, purchasing the day-to-day items, including vehicles. In order to transport clients, you have to have vehicles, and they have to be vans or, you know, multi-seat vehicles. And from a workforce standpoint, we currently have no providers that are able to provide substance use treatment for adolescents in a 5-county area, with the nearest program for adolescents almost an hour away. And I've been recruiting for an adolescent substance use counselor for over a year and have had no applicants. From a cost perspective, any other business owner can adjust their prices to accommodate overall cost changes by either posting prices that are too high, which would decrease the amount of people using my services, or too low, which would create a different issue of overburdening my workforce without being able to compensate. But when we're dealing with medical assistance in the Behavioral Health Fund, we rely solely on the state of Minnesota to determine those rates that allow us to continue to provide quality and evidence-based services, while also allowing us to compensate employees, provide additional evidence-based services that might be uncovered, like arts and crafts or activities or a playground at our facility, and being able to maintain the building and the other overall costs that are involved in running the business. Without private insurance to supplement our operating revenues, we rely almost entirely on the rates established by the legislator. And when those rates lag behind, we are unable to recruit and retain staff in our rural communities, and we struggle to keep our doors open. The rate increases in the House File 1994 are absolutely vital to ensuring the long-term viability of our rural treatment infrastructure. You heard from EOSIS and said, if we don't receive rates, we're gonna have to shut down by the end of the year. They're one of the larger providers. Think about the programs that are the mom and pop programs, in especially in rural communities, where it's one organization or maybe a few clients that they're serving, but those few clients are seeking services at the only place within hours of driving, especially in rural northern Minnesota, where Coochie King County or southern Minnesota down by South Dakota, where they might be the only provider within multiple counties. Recovering Hope Treatment Center also provides an additional overall cost savings by providing a safe place for women and children, and pregnant women to seek services for recovery without burdening the child protection system, care programs, NICUs, hospitalizations, foster care, respite care, jails. Last week alone, we had three women deliver healthy babies in our program. Not in our program, at the local hospital. They were enrolled in our program. And substance use programs, like the other testifiers said, save money in our state by investing in these programs. You're not only saving money, or you aren't just saving money, you're by not investing in these programs, you're not just saving money, you're just moving it to other areas of the budget that are less cost effective. And I also am going to go off my little script and just go a little into, because it was the overall discussion that I've heard, and I wanted to share from like the mental health end of services. And so as a provider in the mental health realm, if I get into this field and I start working with Medicaid clients because I'm maybe getting my license and I'm working with those high acuity clients, as I continue, you start to see this trend where people get fully licensed and they go, you know, I'm not gonna work with Medicaid, because if I work with Medicaid, I have a 30 to 40% no-show rate for my clients. So I'm scheduling more clients to accommodate for that. So you see these providers start to go, I'm just gonna take commercial insurance or employer insurance, right? And then as they kind of see that, they're like, dealing with that is also terrible. Pre-authorizations, pullbacks, clawbacks, denials, not being able to provide services because some insurance company says that you can't. And then we start to see people say, you know what, I'm just going to do private pay. So you have our most experienced providers providing services to this very small subset, and you have the brand new pre-licensed clinicians providing services to our higher acuity clients that definitely need that balance. And so the system itself, in all nursing homes, we heard earlier, assisted living, medical, behavioral health, substance use, something in our system needs to change overall. And I know I'm here just about 1994, but I also wanted to just kind of say that it's a bigger issue too. So thank you for your time today, and let me know if you have questions.
Thank you so much for the testimony. And now we move to members' discussion. Any questions? Seeing none, for your closing remarks, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Members of this committee have heard me talk about the need that we're gonna have this year to stretch dollars as far as we can. And that's why anytime someone has come before us talking about a direct appropriation, I say we need to talk about either like some sort of grant pool, but rates is another way that we can address the statewide issues. And so if we can increase rates, as Dr. Sutherland talked about too, the economic impact that that has across the state is actually to the positive. So it's gonna be a challenging year. We're gonna have to make some hard choices, but I would just ask that we do what we can to support those in the substance use disorder community. And with that, I renew my motion to lay over House File 1994 as amended, or not as amended, that's the previous bill, House File 1994 to be included in a future bill.
Thank you so much. House File 1994 is laid over. Today is Frederick's day. So the next bill is 1995. It started with 93, 94, 95. I think we'll be going in a direction to 2025. Please move forward with the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'd like to start with the A1 amendment right away. It makes the bill smaller, so there's less to talk about.
Representative Frederick moves the House file 1995 to be referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law, and he wants to move House file A1. Can you please briefly explain A1?
The A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, is deleting Sections 2 and Sections 3 out of the bill, so we'll be able to focus on the changes to saying a comprehensive assessment along with the for that.
Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Any objections? Say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The goal of House File 1995 is to change the language about a chemical use assessment to saying a comprehensive assessment. We want to recognize people are whole persons, and this assessment is trying to look at more than just chemical use. And then the other piece of this talks about how these payments or how these assessments are paid for. We don't want someone who is perhaps not doing well in their life to have an additional fee of a comprehensive assessment. And so we want to be able to have that paid for through Medicaid. So, and to make that point, I have a testifier here.
Welcome back. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Brian Zervis with March. So in section one of this bill, what it's looking to do is to, when someone has a driving offense and they're required to get an assessment, a substance disorder assessment, the language that's being added would exempt people that have income eligibility for medical assistance or the behavioral health fund from needing to pay for that assessment because there's already an existing funding mechanism for that provider to access. So we would see this language as reducing a barrier for those folks. As Representative Frederick noted, sections 2 and 3 are being deleted via the amendment. Section 4 was worked on between Department of Human Services and Department of Public Safety to modernize the term. Chemical dependency is an outdated term, and it's throughout that entire statute. So section 4 is an instruction to the reviser to modernize that language. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we now move to members' discussion. Any discussion? Seeing none, it's a good day for you.
Somebody's got to have something.
You're not on the hot seat, so please give us your closing remarks.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Obviously, all of these bills are related to substance use disorder. I think this last one is going to be a challenge, too, but we're going to continue to push as much as we can. So I just appreciate the committee's time. And with that, I renew my motion for House File 1995, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion is adopted. You're on your way to Judiciary.
Thank you.
To the next bill is House File 1894. Representative Vanek moves that House File 1984 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1894 be laid over for consideration in a possible omnibus bill. Thank you, Chair Knorr and Chair Schumacher and members of the committee. Before you today is House File 1894, a bill that would delay the implementation of new adult family foster care rate tiers to 2029 and establish a task force to study these proposed changes and their impact on the future of adult family foster care services in Minnesota. To provide some context, a few years ago, the legislature passed language removing adult family foster care from the disability waiver rate system and placing it under its own flat rate tier structure, scheduled to take effect on January 1st, 2026. Since then, providers have analyzed the proposed rates and raised significant concerns about the potential reductions they may see and what those reductions will mean for individuals receiving care, the stability of providers, and the long-term sustainability of these essential services. House File 1894 recognizes that a thoughtful, informed approach is needed. By delaying the implementation of these rate changes until 2029, we create the necessary time for a dedicated task force comprised of providers, individuals receiving services, and department representatives to review the proposed rates and make recommendations on the payment model and structure moving forward. This ensures that any transition to a new rate system is based on data, sustainability, and the needs of those we serve. This work will produce a report. Representative Gilman, this is for you. You always ask about what's in the report, so I wanted to include that. The report will be submitted to the legislature on August 1st, 2027, that includes the following: a payment rate methodology for family residential services as well as life-sharing services, any additional recommended changes to the services, any legislative changes required to implement the task force recommendations, any legislative modifications to the task force to adequately monitor and implement the new rates. And there is a cost to this work. A fiscal note has been requested but has not received yet. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Johnny Tevet. I'm the Policy and Grassroots Manager for ARM, which is a statewide trade association of residential service providers, providing services through the four disability waivers and supporting people in a variety of different living environments, from a four-person community residential setting to an individual's own home and in a family's home, supporting people through adult family foster care services. Adult family foster care is a service option in which someone can choose to live with the family providing their services. The family foster care provider is licensed under 245D and must follow the same license regulations as a corporate service provider. During the 2023 legislative session, new flat rate tiers for adult family foster care and life sharing services were passed and will be effective January 1st, 2026. This means that these services, which were previously funded through the DWRS, the Disability Waiver Rate System, using the same forms and rate framework that other waiver service recipients use to determine needs and costs of services, will now be moved to a flat rate with no option for rate exception. Our family foster care provider members with ARM have many concerns with these proposed rate tiers. What is perhaps most troubling is that these rate tiers are supposed to be based on MnChoices 2.0, which continues to be delayed. So as of now, providers are living with an underlying sense of dread, not knowing if the new final rates will be able to financially sustain the work they do. With the implementation of these new unknown rates set to take effect in 9 months, it is troublesome to not have an idea of what those rates will be based upon or whether they will be enough to allow providers to keep their doors open. Using past data, we've tried to understand the current financial impact of these tiers. I've been fortunate enough to meet with a lot of family providers across the states in their own homes, and of all the providers I met with, not one indicated they could continue doing this work under the new rates beyond 12 months. With over 1,200 family residential providers in our state, the loss of even a few represents a major loss to the network of providers who do this work. Thousands of adults living with disabilities would effectively find themselves homeless and in quick need of a new place to live and receive care. Minnesota providers should not be subjected to this kind of mass upheaval. It's unfair to them, and it's especially unfair to those living in an adult family foster care home, many of whom have been there for over 30 years. Yes, this is a setting they receive care, but it is also their home. The bill in front of you would delay the effective date for implementation of the new rate tiers, pushing it back to 2029, giving the system much-needed extension to figure out a better solution, which we believe would come from the creation of a task force to further study the impact of the proposed rates and develop recommendations on future reimbursement models with family providers at the table. If we keep the status quo and we implement the flat rates in 2026, we'll see some major disruptions, not just to adult family foster care homes, but the ecosystem of disability providers across the state. At a time of staffing shortages, massive proposed budget cuts at the state level, and even more uncertainty with Medicaid, this would be an irresponsible and dangerous thing to do, sticking to the status quo. Now more than ever, it is time to ensure that all services are sustainable going forward, especially ones as cost-effective as adult family foster care. So I thank you for your time, and I'll hand it over to Alicia.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Awesome. Hello, Mr. Chair and House members. My name is Alicia Olson, and I am an adult foster provider. We're also called residential family services. There's lots of titles. thrown around here. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 1894. I am located in Zimmerman, Minnesota, and I have had my home open for 5 years. However, I have been in the field for 17 years as I was a supervisor at a CRS prior. My experience enables me to know both the similarities and differences that are in both settings, running each type of home as well as the services offered to residents. Each setting is similar in its structure, yet very different in its approach. That approach can often mean the difference between someone merely surviving and someone thriving in an environment that better suits them. Minnesota has been on the right track by offering choices, choices that clients get to make when it comes to their housing. As changes are being made to now how the FRS system is done, like decreasing our beds from 4 down to 2 and removing us from the DWRS come January 1st of next year, this wonderful choice is at risk of being available. We are begging for a seat at the table to get rates that are livable to prevent mass closures across the state. As providers, it's difficult to imagine looking at our clients in the eyes, the clients who have grown to become like family, who have lived in our homes for years, sometimes decades, and tell them that we have to close because we cannot survive off of less than minimum wage. They have chosen a family atmosphere, and now their choice no longer matters because a budget change makes it unavailable to them. We are begging for a seat to explain our operating costs. Think about your day-to-day family events and costs. Every little thing has a price associated with it when you're the head of the household. As providers, we're paying for more than your standard operating costs to maintain that family atmosphere that they want and need. Life-improving things like partaking in sports or activities out of the home, vacations, proper meals, and little things like going to see a movie. Those little things that create family memories and are rarely free. So we're begging for a chance to explain what we do, why it's a critical part of that ecosystem of disability care. We aren't just sleeping in our own beds or hanging out. We're on suicide watch, changing briefs, helping with ADLs while staying 10 steps ahead to prevent those behaviors or medical emergencies. Most times, it happens also when we're on our own vacations. Our cuts set to start on 1/26 are based off of that Men's Choice assessment that's thankfully been delayed. But due to that, every time we ask where our tier is going to fall, no one can tell us. Regardless, we're not going to be able to pay our supplemental staff minimum wage either. Help us prevent unneeded chaos to potentially letting thousands of adults living with disability become unhoused. Delay the cut and help us get a task force assigned so that we can try our best to keep the people we care deeply for in the homes that they're thriving in. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else who wants to testify on this bill in the public? Seeing none, members' discussion. I don't see any other member. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. So the delay for the FRS flat rate implementation, you want to put it to 2029. Were you considering the next fiscal year? Because I think you are extending just beyond the fiscal year. Mr. Timbet.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, I think that's something we'd be open to discussing further. Right now, the way the bill was introduced last year, we're just kicking it back one more year since we're 1 year closer to that deadline, but would be something we would consider.
Representative Frampson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is probably one of the hottest items in my district. I have a few providers that provide this type of care, and one of the emails that I received recently from a provider said for their home, the rates cuts would be nearly 65% of their annual income. And the question that I was asked, would you maintain your current job position for 65% less pay? In a legislature that prides itself on making sure people have livable wages, I think that it we should take the testifying as a warning and take their concerns very seriously. And I certainly support pushing this off, well, as long as possible, but until we can figure out a way to make it work for everyone.
Any other member discussion? I think this is an important conversation. We had a town hall last year. Some of your residents, actually from your district, Representative Franson, came to my district for that town hall, so to talk about this very issue. So your closing remarks, Representative Franson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. As you heard, adult family foster care provides critical support to individuals across Minnesota. and we must ensure that any changes to its funding structure are sustainable and fair. House File 1894 gives us time to get that right, protecting access to care while engaging providers, individuals, and experts in a thoughtful review process. I thank you for your support, and I renew my motion that House File 1894 be laid over for possible inclusion.
I thank you. House File 1894 is laid over. Members, that was our last bill. I just wanted to check in with Chair Schumacher for next week.
Beats me what's going on. We'll have our update coming out soon.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So, members, we don't have any further agenda items before us. We are now adjourned.